Chapter 12, Business and Money. What role does international business play in operations like Cuba and wars like the Congo, Vietnam, and Angola? In Angola, several transnational giants, including Gulf, Boeing, De Beers, Mobil, and numerous smaller companies, had interests in the outcome. Before the war, Gulf Oil had exclusive access to the Cabinda oil fields. Boeing had contracted to sell two of its 737 jetliners to TAG, the Angolan national airline, and to install commercial radar control systems at the principal Angolan airports. In September 1975, a New York financier interviewed me for employment as his company's Angolan representative. The offer was fun, but it was contingent on a quick and satisfactory resolution of the war, at which time the financier was poised to exploit Angolan diamonds and other mineral resources. Since 1968, Gulf had been pumping 150,000 barrels a day from 120 wells off the coast of Cabinda. It was paying $500 million per year in royalties to the Angolan colonial government for this oil. All that was interrupted in the fall of 1975. Gulf did make the September payment of $116 million to the Bank of Angola. The next payments due were $100 million on December 11th and $102 million on January 15th, 1976. On November 11th, the MPLA took control of the Bank of Angola and the dossier of contracts with Gulf. And by defeating Mobutu's November 6th invasion of Cabinda, it maintained physical control of the Cabindan oil fields. The war created serious problems for Gulf. Not only was the flow of oil threatened, there were also the lives of its 420 technicians to be considered. 17 of them were Americans. In early November 1975, because of the fighting, Gulf was obliged to suspend operations and evacuate its employees from Cabinda. The MPLA urged Gulf to resume operations and guaranteed its technicians' safety. Gulf would gladly have taken the MPLA deal. There was no threat of nationalization, as the MPLA needed Gulf's assistance indefinitely to keep the vital revenues coming in. The working group was exasperated. Our total budget for IA feature was only $31.7 million. Within 2 months, Gulf would yield $200 million cash to the MPLA. CIA and State Department attorneys repeatedly discussed means of blocking Gulf's payments to the MPLA, and pressure was brought to bear. The FNLA and UNITA were jointly attempting to establish a provisional government, but were unable to gain recognition, and Gulf could not be persuaded to deliver the money to Roberto or Savimbi unless they controlled Cabinda. On December 23rd, Gulf compromised and put $125 million in an escrow bank account. At the same time, Boeing wanted very much to consummate its deal and deliver the two 737s to TAG. The MPLA wanted the planes. The money, $30 million, had already been paid. 12 TAG pilots were in Seattle training to fly them. TAG was also planning to buy 4 shortened Airbuses at $5 million each. Boeing was eager to place its crews in Luanda to begin working on the radar systems. American technicians and businessmen were still welcome despite the war, the Cubans, and the antagonism between the United States and the MPLA. Realists thought the war should have been over by mid-November. The business interests were eager to bury the hatchet and get on with commerce. But the CIA, the working group, and Henry Kissinger were not about to permit the delivery of new American jet airliners to Luanda. Why provide the means for the MPLA to fly their delegations around the world, drumming up support? In November, the State Department withdrew the export licenses for the planes. A TAG delegation promptly flew to Washington to lobby for the release of the 737s. They were joined in Washington by George Wilson, the president of Boeing. The TAG delegation consisted of two contacts of the Luanda station, encrypted IA Moffat 1 and IA Porky 1, who were cordial to the CIA but unrecruited. They were accompanied from Lisbon to Washington by Bob Timmons, the chief of the Luanda station, who had evacuated Luanda on November 3rd. In 3 months in Luanda, Timmons had come to share G.P. Swish's view that the MPLA was best qualified to run the country, that it was not demonstrably hostile to the United States, and that the United States should make peace with it as quickly as possible. In Washington, Timmons made his views known inside CIA headquarters, while Wilson and the Angolans separately petitioned the State Department. But the momentum of the war was too great. Timmons and Wilson were told that a program affecting the United States' national security was at stake. Then Ambassador Mulcahy had a bright idea. Why not ask Wilson, the president of Boeing, to convey to the MPLA an official but very discreet statement of our country's official position vis-à-vis Angola? The State Department drafted the message, and I sent someone from the task force to rent a room at Washington's Statler Hilton for a meeting between Wilson, I.A. Porky I, and I.A. Moffat I. Timmons made the introductions and left before Wilson delivered the message. It read, "The United States cannot stand by for a Soviet power play in Africa. If the MPLA is willing to work for a political solution and compromise with its rivals, the United States is willing to back a peaceful settlement. The MPLA would do well to heed our advice that no government can plan the reconstruction in post-war Angola without United States and Western help. No government can obtain the technical and financial resources to stimulate economic development without American consent. In fact, the United States would be quite responsive and helpful to a coalition government that was not dependent on the Soviet Union. The United States government is prepared to think further about the supply of Boeing aircraft to Angola and is willing to undertake further discussions depending on the courses of events in Angola. This message should be given to Luandan authorities. As the MPLA is aware, access to sophisticated technology is a privilege. The present Boeing case is just one, but a good example of the advantages of having access to American technology." This logic seems to have left the MPLA unmoved, for the war went on as before. Almost daily, the IA feature officers would meet to worry about money, to count what had been spent, and reprogram the remainder. In general terms, here is how the money went. Of the original $6 million, $2,750,000 was given to Mobutu in cash to encourage him to send more arms to the FNLA and UNITA. Roberto and Savimbi were allotted $2 million for the general operation of their movements, each to receive $200,000 per month for 5 months. The chiefs of station Kinshasa and Lusaka insisted on controlling these funds, and specified that Roberto and Savimbi should not be told how much they were to receive. Each COS claimed one of the movements. Roberto belonged to Kinshasa, and Savimbi to Lusaka. Each COS wanted to dole money to his leader, or to be able to make cash purchases on his leader's behalf. The next $8 million, released on July 27th, was allocated primarily for the shipload of arms and for the procurement of airplanes to haul material from Kinshasa into Angola. On August 20th, an additional $10.7 million was authorized for more arms, aircraft, mercenaries, and maintenance of the Liberation Forces. The 1,000-man arms package for the invasion of Cabinda came from these funds. On November 27th, President Ford approved the final $7 million, which was intended for yet more arms, the recruitment of mercenaries, and the lease of a C-130 aircraft for use in Angola. The total budget of $31.7 million was applied only to the procurement of arms and for IA feature operations. The salaries and operational expenses of the hundreds of CIA staff employees and the CIA facilities involved in the program, certainly totaling several million dollars, were charged to the CIA's fiscal year 76 personnel and support budget and were not included in the $31.7 million. The $31.7 million was drawn from the CIA FY75 Contingency Reserve Fund. Footnote. The Constitution clearly provides that the Congress has the responsibility to declare war and to supervise the budget, and that the budget will be open for public inspection. These provisions of the Constitution have never been amended, and the CIA's covert wars are literally unconstitutional. Through the CIA and its secret contingency funds, the President is able to wage a small war without congressional approval and without its budget being published. In Vietnam, a president's limited war took on global significance. See President Kennedy Wages a Secret War by Ralph Stavins, New York, Random House, 1971. End footnote. With each incremental increase, the process of approval began with a recommendation drawn up by Africa Division and presented to the 40 Committee. The 40 Committee tentatively approved the expenditure, pending presidential endorsement. President Ford approved the expenditure, and the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, a separate office in the executive branch, then approached the CIA to supervise the expenditure of the money. OMB had no authority to comment on the operational justification of any expenditures, but as auditor was responsible to ensure the money was spent as intended. When the CIA FY75 Contingency Reserve Fund was exhausted on November 27, 1975, by the allocation of the last $7 million, the Angola program was stymied. An effort to obtain an additional $28 million from the Department of Defense budget was blocked. Additional funds could only be provided by the Congress, and it refused to cooperate. Throughout the war, we in Africa Division at CIA headquarters were careful, to the extent our catch-as-catch-can accounting system permitted, to provide OMB with accurate information of what we were doing with our IA feature funds. We were all highly sensitive to the scrutiny the CIA was receiving, and fearful that there would be an investigation which would, if irregularities were discovered, hold us individually responsible a la Watergate. Only in the CIA's fiscal annex to the IA feature project outline, dated January 26, 1976, did I detect a thread of fraud. The fiscal annex perpetuated the big lie of the original 40 Committee options paper by stating that the purpose of IA feature activity was to provide assistance to the FNLA and UNITA, to enable them to repulse attacks by the MPLA, thereby creating a sufficiently stable situation to allow for a political settlement. Typically, CIA field commanders had an independent perspective. They were concerned with the guns, bullets, and personalities of war, more than with Washington's bureaucratic and political problems. The three principals, the chiefs of the Kinshasa, Lusaka, and Pretoria stations, were unapologetic hawks, openly determined to defeat the Soviet-backed MPLA. The CIA station in Kinshasa was the focal point of the logistical support provided both to Mobutu and to the Angolan liberation movements. All of our arms flights went to Kinshasa, and then directly through the military side of Nijili Airport and into Angola. When the American Champion deposited its cargo in Matadi on the lower Congo River, 144 railroad cars hauled the arms into Kinshasa. There they were warehoused until they could be flown into Angola. The experience was maddening because of Zairean inefficiency and indifference. With paramilitary, logistics, and air experts cajoling, bribing, and bullying the Zaireans into getting the arms to the airport on time, and in some cases, Americans driving the forklifts themselves, the near impossible was accomplished. The American Champion docked in Matadi on September 12th, and on October 7th, IA feature airplanes began lifting 10 tons a day into Angola. The Lusaka station ran intelligence-gathering teams into Silva Porta, coordinated with President Kawanda of Zambia and with Savimbi, and contributed to the propaganda campaign. Pretoria maintained close liaison with the South African government. The weakest link in the arms flow was between Kinshasa and the Angolan bases. Initially, Mobutu's C-130s and DC-4 did the hauling, but this involved an intolerable liability for the CIA. Mobutu's attachment to his C-130s was fabled, and the Zaire economy was nearly bankrupt. If one of his C-130s were lost in Angola, Mobutu would demand that it be replaced, and at $10 to $15 million each, the CIA's Angola program could not underwrite such a loss. The obvious solution of using U.S. Air Force tactical air transports was constantly sought by the agency. But here the magic phone calls didn't work. They inevitably reached the desk of the Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, who steadfastly said no. Ours was a controversial, covert CIA program, and Schlesinger wouldn't let traceable U.S. Air Force planes and crews enter the Angolan airspace. From August 1975 through January 1976, we sought to lease a commercial C-130 without success. Such planes are expensive, $1 million rent for 3 months without pilots, and of course impossible to insure commercially for use in an Angolan bush war. They also require specially trained crews, which we were unable to locate for mercenary service. But from August on, the airspace between Kinshasa and the FNLA UNITA bases was busy with smaller planes flown by Portuguese Angolan pilots. These planes, belonging to businesses which had operated in Angola, De Beers among others, were simply commandeered by the CIA in the FNLA's name and put into service flying arms into Angola. This unorthodox source of air cargo was so economical, the CIA encouraged its extension. Word went out to Portuguese still in Luanda that the beneficent Americans would pay $30,000 to any pilot who managed to skyjack a plane load of MPLA arms and bring it to Kinshasa. Eventually, the CIA's little air force controlled 9 stolen aircraft, including 1 Aztec, 1 Cessna 172, 1 Cessna 180, 1 Cessna 310, a Rockwell Turbo Commander, 1 Mooney, 2 Fokker F-27s, and 1 Alouette III helicopter. Another F-27 was leased from Mobutu's commercial air wing, and the Lusaka station managed to hire a Viscount for $106,000 plus operating costs. These 8 planes hauled much of the 1,500 tons of material from Kinshasa into Angola, with a periodic assist from Mobutu's C-130s and South African C-130s. In Kinshasa, efforts to assemble a navy capable of interdicting shipping between Luanda and Cabinda and supporting coastal infantry action were equally ingenious, but much less effective. The 2 high-performance Swifts were offloaded from the American Champion directly onto the Congo River at Matadi, and CIA maritime experts turned them over to Zaireans, who, it was thought, had had experience with similar craft on Lake Tanganyika. The CIA maritime team included only 1 French speaker, an officer who had graduated from the agency's French language school in July 1975 with an elementary rating. The turnover was effected, at least in the sense that the agency officers returned to Kinshasa and the Zaireans headed the Swifts downriver at full throttle. 6 weeks later, both boats were inoperative from abuse and sloppy maintenance, and the maritime officers returned to Matadi in a vain attempt to get them back in shape. Bypassing CIA bureaucracy, the Kinshasa station managed to obtain a large fishing boat, the Christina, and hired a Portuguese crew to man it. It also obtained a lovely 26-foot pleasure yacht, the Sagittarius, with twin inboards, long-range tanks, and a wooden hull. The Sagittarius was purchased by the Luanda station and smuggled out of the Luanda harbor in a high-seas adventure. Taken to Ambriz, it was intended for use against unarmed vessels which were supporting the MPLA. However, as no operations were mounted against coastal shipping, the Sagittarius contributed little. Eventually, it was moved up the coast in concert with the FNLA retreat, and at the end of the war, was maintained for outings on the Congo River by individuals who had aided the program in Kinshasa. 24 rubber assault craft with outboard motors, shipped from the United States into Angola for commando raids, were misplaced in Kinshasa and could not be located when they were needed. Kinshasa station was indeed active, with St. Martin taking his role as the resident warlord seriously. He continuously proposed extraneous operations involving station support assets, including an agent called I.A. Moldy I, who was a Portuguese-Angolan businessman with operations in Luanda and Kinshasa. First, the Kinshasa and Luanda stations cooperated in pouching the personal effects of a non-American agent in the U.S. State Department, unclassified diplomatic pouch, arguing that they included printing materials which could be used in the Kinshasa propaganda effort. Other printing materials were abundantly available in Kinshasa. Then we discovered in the Kinshasa station accountings that $50,000 of the money which was allocated for Roberto had been spent to purchase an ice plant on the lower Congo River for I.A. Moldy I. There had been no discussion of this purchase, and we were flabbergasted. Agency regulations permit a chief of station to spend $500 without prior headquarters approval, if documentation and justification are submitted in the next monthly accountings. Normally, a $50,000 expenditure would require staff work at headquarters and at least the DDO's signature. But the fiscal annex of the IA feature project outline simply waived the usual controls. Over $5 million was delivered in cash to Mobutu, Roberto, and Savimbi by the chiefs of station in Kinshasa and Lusaka, accounted for only by signatures from the liberation leaders and their representatives. Other money was deposited in European bank accounts, over which the CIA had no control. This arrangement placed enormous faith in the honesty of everyone involved. No one in the task force raised any question about it. It was approved by Colby and his controllers. All case officers live in glass houses, being required to pass funds to agents in all kinds of situations. The only difference in IA feature was that case officers were dispersing millions rather than hundreds of dollars. The justification for the ice plant was baroque. I.A. Moldy I would produce ice to preserve fish for the FNLA. In discussions with Bantam and Potts, I pointed out that ice was indeed used on the Congo River to preserve fish for the Europeans and rich Africans in the cities. The African population in the bush eats dried fish, which has the virtue of not spoiling quickly even in the tropical sun and humidity. There was no way of carrying ice-packed fish to Ambrise for distribution to the fighting fronts. My arguments against the ice plant were brushed aside. The money was already expended, and it would be unpleasant to bring the matter up for review. In staff meeting, Pott said at least twice that one shouldn't try to second-guess the man in the field. Carl Bantam recalled that in Laos, the CIA had bought a lumber mill, which turned out to be a gold mine, making a profit and providing cover for operational activities. The ice plant wasn't mentioned again. But the fishing boat, the Christina, also involved I.A. Moldy I. Kinshasa Station wanted to buy it, for $150,000, in I.A. Moldy I's name, allegedly for use in patrolling the coast and hauling supplies to the FNLA. I argued that $150,000 was too much money for our budget. The Christina was an old tub, too slow and cumbersome for coastal patrol, or to interdict the flow of anything, much less arms between the Congo, Brazzaville, and Luanda. Any supplies it hauled for us would have to go through the congested Matadi port, where even priority shipments were delayed for weeks. We could deliver supplies from Kinshasa to Ambrise by trucks in less time and with a smaller investment. Potts listened, politely, as always, then noted that, of course, we could not approve the purchase of ships without more detailed information, including an insurance underwriter's appraisal of the ship's condition and value, and the station's justification for its use. I took notes, and we sent a cable to Kinshasa asking for this information. When Kinshasa did not respond directly, the matter was dropped at headquarters. However, the Kinshasa station nevertheless managed to acquire the ship. Presumably, they passed Roberto the cash to buy it for them, and manned it with a Portuguese crew. Then they requested that headquarters provide naval mortars to arm it. St. Martin also proposed to mine the Luanda harbor. But with this, he did not get far. Special Operations Group reacted vigorously, pointing out that mine-laying operations are complicated and require a small navy of specialized ships and planes. St. Martin was proposing to fly an F-27 over the harbor of Luanda, shoving a few mines out the door, and thereby rendering the harbor unsafe for shipping. That these mines would float around in the South Atlantic, menacing all shipping, was not taken into account. Nor could such mines come from the FNLA alone. They would obviously be American. There would be no plausible denial. As cables went back and forth, St. Martin tried to resolve the technical arguments with a second scheme, in which he would order a nocturnal raid on Luanda Harbor, which would feint a mine-laying operation and perhaps blow a small hole in a selected ship. The world might then think the harbor was mined and ships would avoid it. This was discussed in the working group and quickly shuttered out of consideration. But Kinshasa Station brought it up two or three times more as the tide of fighting turned against the FNLA forces near Luanda. And firecrackers. Unable to motivate the FNLA soldiers, the Zairians, or the Portuguese commandos to patrol or raid a mile beyond the front lines, Kinshasa repeatedly cabled to headquarters requests for firefight simulators, firecrackers rigged to sound like small arms fire, to be dropped in the Luanda suburbs by one of our stolen airplanes.